That answer was an easy one. I'm a nurse, Miss Brown. It's my job to take care of sick people. Billy and Rick, she said next, remembering again. Memory for Doris was a variable and spotty thing, mainly the recollection of pain. They're not here, O'Toole assured her. She paused before going on, and to her surprise found satisfaction in the words. I don't think they'll be bothering you again. There was almost comprehension in the patient's eyes, Sandy thought. Almost. And that was encouraging.
I have to go, please.
She started to move and then noticed the restraints. Okay, wait a minute. Sandy removed the straps. You think you can stand okay?
Try, she groaned.
Doris rose perhaps 30 degrees before her body betrayed her. Sandy got her sitting up, but the girl couldn't quite make her head sit straight on her neck. Standing her up was even harder, but it wasn't that far to the bathroom, and the dignity of making it there was worth the pain and the effort for her patient. Sandy sat her down there, holding her hand. She took the time to dampen a washcloth and do her face. That's a step forward, Sarah Rosen observed from the door. Sandy turned and smiled by way of communicating the patient's condition. They put a robe on her before bringing her back to the bedroom. Sandy changed the linen first, while Sarah got a cup of tea into the patient. You're looking much better today, Doris, the physician said, watching her drink.
I feel awful.
That's okay, Doris. You have to feel awful before you can start to feel better. Yesterday you weren't feeling much of anything. Think you can try some toast?
So hungry.
Another good sign, Sandy noted. The look in her eyes was so bad that both doctor and nurse could feel the skull-rending headache, which today would be treated only with an ice pack. They'd spent a week leeching the drugs from her system, and this wasn't the time for adding new ones. Lean your head back. Doris did that, resting her head on the back of the overstuffed chair Sandy had once bought at a garage sale. Her eyes were closed and her limbs so weak that her arms merely rested on the fabric while Sarah handled the individual slices of dry toast. The nurse took a brush and started working on her patient's hair. It was filthy and needed washing, but just getting it straightened out would help, she thought. Medical patients put an amazing amount of stock in their physical appearance, and however odd or illogical it might seem to be, it was real, and therefore something which Sandy recognized as important. She was a little surprised by Doris's shudder a minute or so after she started.
Am I alive?
The alarm in the question was startling. Very much so, Sarah answered, almost smiling at the exaggeration. She checked her blood pressure. 122/78. Excellent, Sandy noted. It was the best reading all week.
Pam.
What's that? Sarah asked. It took Doris a moment to go on, still wondering if this were life or death, and if the latter, what part of eternity she had found.
Hair. When she was dead. Brushed her hair.
Dear God, Sarah thought. Sam had related that one part of the post-mortem report to her, morosely sipping a highball at their home in Green Spring Valley. He hadn't gone further than that. It hadn't been necessary. The photo on the front page of the paper had been quite sufficient. Dr. Rosen touched her patient's face as gently as she could.
Doris, who killed Pam?
She thought that she could ask this without increasing the patient's pain. She was wrong.
Rick and Billy and Bert and Henry killed her, watching.
The girl started crying, and the racking sobs only magnified the shuddering waves of pain in her head. Sarah held back on the toast. Nausea might soon follow.
They made you watch? Yes.
Doris's voice was like one from the grave.
Let's not think about that now.
Sarah's body shuddered with the kind of chill she associated with death itself as she stroked the girl's cheek.
There, Sandy said brightly, hoping to distract her. That's much better. Tired.
Okay, let's get you back to bed, dear.
Both women helped her up. Sandy left the robe on her, setting an ice bag on her forehead. Doris faded off into sleep almost at once. "Breakfast is on," Sarah told the nurse. "Leave the restraints off for now."
"Brushed your hair?"
"What?" Sandy asked, heading down the stairs. "I didn't read the report."
"I saw the photo, Sarah. What they did to her. Pam, her name was, right?"
Sandy was almost too tired to remember things herself.
"Yes. She was my patient, too," Dr. Rosen confirmed. "Sam said it was pretty bad. The odd thing, somebody brushed her hair out after she was dead. He told me that. I guess it was Doris who did it."
"Oh."
Sandy opened the refrigerator and got milk for the morning coffee.
"I see."
"I don't," Dr. Rosen said angrily. "I don't see how people can do that. Another few months and Doris would have died. As it was, any closer."
"I'm surprised you didn't admit her under a Jane Doe," Sandy observed.
"After what happened to Pam, taking a chance like that, and it would have meant..."
O'Toole nodded. "Yes, it would have meant endangering John. That's what I understand."
"Hmm?"
"They killed her friend and made her watch. The things they did to her. To them, she was just a thing."
"Billy and Rick," Sandy said aloud, not quite realizing it. "Bert and Henry," Sarah corrected. "I don't think the other two will be hurting anybody anymore." The two women shared a look, their eyes meeting across the breakfast table, their thoughts identical, though both were distantly shocked at the very idea of holding them, much less understanding them.
"Good."
"Well, we've shaken down every bum west of Charles Street," Douglas told his lieutenant. "We've had one cop cut. Not seriously, but the wino is in for a long drying-out period at Jessup. A bunch have been puked on," he added with a smirk, "but we still don't know crap. He's not out there, Em. Nothing new in a week." And it was true. The word had gotten out to the street, surprisingly slow but inevitable. Street pushers were being careful to the point of paranoia. That might or might not explain the fact that not a single one had lost his life in over a week.
"He's still out there, Tom."
"Maybe so, but he's not doing anything."
"In which case, everything he did was to get Farmer and Grayson," Ryan noted with a look at the sergeant.
"You don't believe that?"
"No, I don't. And don't ask me why, because I don't know why."
"Well, it would help if Charon could tell us something. He's been pretty good taking people down. Remember that bust he did with the Coast Guard?"
Ryan nodded.
"That was a good one, but he's slowed down lately."
"So have we, Em," Sergeant Douglas pointed out. "The only thing we really know about this guy is that he's strong, he wears new sneaks, and he's white. We don't know age, weight, size, motive, what kind of car he drives."
"Motive. We know he's pissed about something. We know he's very good at killing. We know he's ruthless enough to kill people just to cover his own activities. And he's patient." Ryan leaned back.
"Patient enough to take time off?"
Tom Douglas had a more troubling idea.
"Smart enough to change tactics."
That was a disturbing thought. Ryan considered it. What if he'd seen the shakedowns? What if he'd decided that you could only do one thing so long and then you had to do something else? What if he'd developed information from William Grayson, and that information was now taking him in other directions? Out of town, even? What if they'd never know, never close these cases? That would be a professional insult to Ryan, who hated leaving cases open, but he had to consider it. Despite dozens of field interviews, they had not turned up so much as a single witness except for Virginia Charles, and she'd been sufficiently traumatized that her information was scarcely believable, and contradicted the one really useful piece of forensic evidence they had. The suspect had to be taller than she had said, had to be younger, and sure as hell was as strong as an NFL linebacker. He wasn't a wino, but had chosen to camouflage himself as one. You just didn't see people like that. How did you describe a stray dog?
"The Invisible Man," Ryan said quietly, finally giving the case a name.
"He should have killed Mrs. Charles."
"You know what we've got here?"
Douglas snorted. Somebody I don't want to meet alone.
Three groups to take Moscow out?
Sure, why not, Zacharias replied. It's your political leadership, isn't it? It's a huge communications center. And even if you get the Politburo out, they'll still get most of your military and political command and control.
We have ways to get our important people out, Grishinov objected out of professional and national pride.
Sure.
Robin almost laughed, Grishinov saw. Part of him was insulted, but on reflection he was pleased with himself that the American colonel felt that much at ease now.
Kolya, we have things like that, too. We have a real ritzy shelter set up in West Virginia for Congress and all that. The first helicopter squadron is at Andrews, and their mission is to get VIPs the heck out of Dodge. But guess what? The derned helicopters can't hop all the way to the shelter and back without refueling on the return leg. Nobody thought about that when they selected the shelter, because that was a political decision. Guess what else? We've never tested the evacuation system. Have you tested yours?
Grishinov sat down next to Zacharias on the floor, his back against the dirty concrete wall. Nikolai Yevgenievich just looked down and shook his head, having learned yet more from the American.
You see? You see why I say we'll never fight a war? We're alike. No, Robin, we've never tested it. We've never tried to evacuate Moscow since I was a child in the snow. Our big shelter is at Jiguli. It's a big stone. Not a mountain, like a big bubble? I don't know the word, a huge circle of stone from the center of the earth.
Monolith, like Stone Mountain in Georgia?
Grishinov nodded. There was no harm in giving secrets to this man, was there?
The geologists say it is immensely strong, and we tunneled into it back in the late 1950s. I've been there twice. I helped supervise the Air Defense Office when they were building it. We expect, this is the truth, Robin, we expect to get our people there by train.
It won't matter. We know about it. If you know where it is, you can take it out, just a matter of how many bombs you put there.
The American had 100 grams of vodka in him.
Probably the Chinese do, too. But they'll go for Moscow anyway, especially if it's a surprise attack.
Three groups?
That's how I'd do it.
Robin's feet straddled an air navigation chart of the southeastern Soviet Union. Three vectors from these three bases, three aircraft each, two to carry the bombs, one a protective jammer. Jammer takes the lead. Bring in all three groups online, like, spaced wide like this. He traced likely courses on the map. Start your penetration descent here. Take 'em right into these valleys, and by the time they hit the plains, steps. Kolya corrected. They're through your first line of defense, okay? They're smoking in low, like 300 feet. Maybe they don't even jam at first. Maybe you have one special group, even. The guys you really train.
What do you mean, Robin?
You have night flights into Moscow. Airliners, I mean.
Of course.
Well, what say you take a Badger, and you leave the strobes on, okay? And maybe you have little glow lights down the fuselage that you can turn on and off. You know, like windows? Hey, I'm an airliner.
You mean?
It's something we looked at once. There's a squadron with the light kit still at Pease, I think. That used to be the job. The B-47's based in England. If we ever decided like you guys were going to go after us, from intelligence or something, okay? You gotta have a plan for everything. That was one of ours. We called it Jump Shot. Probably in the dead files now. That was one of LeMay's specials. Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, and Jiguli. Three birds targeted there, two weapons each. Decap your whole political and military command structure. Hey, look, I'm an airliner.
It would work, Grishinov thought with an eerie chill. The right time of year, the right time of day. The bomber comes in on a regularly scheduled airliner route. Even in a crisis, the very illusion of something normal would be like a touchstone while people looked for the unusual. Maybe an air defense squadron would put an aircraft up, a young pilot standing night alert while the senior men slept. He'd close to 1,000 meters or so, but at night,
At night, your mind saw what the brain told it to see. Lights on the fuselage, well, of course, it's an airliner. What bomber would be lit up? That was one up plan the KGB had never tumbled to. How many more gifts would Zacharias give him? Anyway, if I was John Chinaman, that's one option. If they don't have much imagination and go with a straight attack over this terrain, yeah, they can do that. Probably one group is diversionary. They have a real target, too, but short of Moscow. They fly in high, off vector. About this far out, he swept a hand across the map, they make a radical turn and hit something. You can decide what's important. Lots of good targets there. Chances are your fighters keep after them, right?
Da.
They'd think the inbound bombers were turning away for a secondary target. The other two groups loop around from another direction and they smoke in low. One of 'em's going to make it, too. We've played it out a million times, Kolya. We know your radars. We know your bases. We know your airplanes. We know how you train. You're not that hard to beat. And the Chinese, they studied with you, right? You taught them. They know your doctrine and everything. It was how he said it. No guile at all. And this was a man who had penetrated the North Vietnamese air defenses over 80 times. 80 times. So how do I defend against it? Robin shrugged, bending down to examine the chart again. I need better maps, but first thing, you examine the passes one at a time. You remember that a bomber isn't a fighter. He can't maneuver all that great, especially low. Most of what he's doing is keeping the airplane from crunching into the ground, right? I don't know about you, but that makes me nervous. He's going to pick a valley he can maneuver in, especially at night. You put your fighters there. You put ground radars there. You don't need big, sexy ones. That's just a bell ringer. Then you plan to catch him when he comes out.
Move the defenses back? I can't do that.
You put your defenses where they can work, Kolya, not to follow a dotted line on a piece of paper. Or do you like eating Chinese all that much? That's always been a weakness with you people. By the way, it also shortens your lines, right? You save money and assets. Next thing, you remember that the other guy, he knows how pilots think, too. A kill is a kill, right? Maybe there's decoy groups designed to draw your people out, okay? We have scads of radar lures we plan to use. You have to allow for that. You control your people. They stay in their sectors unless you have a really good reason to move them. Colonel Grishinov had studied his profession for more than 20 years, had studied Luftwaffe documents not merely related to prisoner interrogation, but also classified studies of how the Kammhuber line had been set up. This was incredible, almost enough to make him take a drink himself. But not quite, he told himself. This wasn't a briefing document in the making, wasn't a learned white paper for delivery at the Voroshilov Academy. This was a learned book, highly classified, but a book. Origin and Evolution of American Bomber Doctrine. From such a book, he could go on to Marshall stars, all because of his American friend. Let's all stay back here, Marty Young said. They're shooting all live stuff. Makes sense to me, Dutch said. I'm used to having things go off a couple hundred yards behind me. And 400 knots of Delta V, Greer added for him. A lot safer that way, James, Maxwell pointed out. They stood behind an earthen berm, the official military term for a pile of dirt, 200 yards from the camp. It made watching difficult, but two of the five had aviator's eyes, and they knew where to look. How long have they been moving in?
About an hour.
Any time now, Young breathed.
I can't hear a thing, Admiral Maxwell whispered.
It was hard enough to see the sight. The buildings were visible only because of their straight lines, something which nature abhors for one reason or another. Further concentration revealed the dark rectangles of windows. The guard towers, erected only that day, were hard to spot as well.
There's a few tricks we play, Marty Young noted. Everybody gets vitamin A supplements for night vision. Maybe a few percentage points of improvement in night vision. You play every card in the deck, right?
All they heard was the wind whispering through the treetops. There was a surreal element to being in the woods like this. Maxwell and Young were accustomed to the hum of an aircraft engine and the faint glow of instrument lights that their eyes scanned automatically between outward sweeps for hostile aircraft, and the gentle floating sensation of an aircraft moving through the night sky. Being rooted to the land gave the feeling of motion that didn't exist as they waited to see something they had never experienced.
There.
Bad news if you saw him move, Maxwell observed. Sir, Sender Green doesn't have a parking lot with white cars on it, the voice pointed out. The fleeting shadow had been silhouetted against it, and only Kelly had seen it in any case.
I guess that's right, Mr. Clark.
The radio sitting on the berm had been transmitting only the noise of static. That changed now, with four long dashes. They were answered at intervals by one, then two, then three, then four dots.
"Team's in place," Kelly whispered. "Hold your ears. The senior grenadier takes the first shot when he's ready, and that's the kickoff."
"Shit," Greer sneered. He soon regretted it.
The first thing they heard was a distant mutter of twin-bladed helicopter rotors. Designed to make heads turn, and even though every man at the berm knew the plan in intimate detail, it still worked, which pleased Kelly no end. He'd drawn up much of the plan, after all. All heads turned but his. Kelly thought he might have caught a glimpse of the tritium-painted M79 sights of one grenadier, but it might as easily have been the blink of a lonely lightning bug. He saw the muted flash of a single launch, and not a second later the blinding white, red, black flash of a fragmentation grenade against the floor of one of the towers. The sudden, sharp bark made the men at his side jump, but Kelly wasn't paying attention to that. The tower where men and guns would have been disintegrated. The echo had not yet dispersed through the theater of pines when the other three were similarly destroyed. 5 seconds later, the gunships came skimming in over the treetops, not 50 feet separating their rotors as miniguns ripped into the barracks building, two long neon fingers reaching in. The grenadiers were already pumping white phosphorus rounds into the windows, and any semblance of night vision was lost in an instant.
Jesus!
The way that the spreading fountains of burning phosphorus were concealed inside the building made the spectacle only more horrid, while the miniguns concentrated on the exits.
"Yeah," Kelly said, loudly to make himself heard. "Anybody inside is a crispy critter. The smart ones who try to run come right into the mini-fire. Slick."
The fire element of the Marine Assault Force continued to pour fire into the barracks and admin buildings while the snatch team raced to the prison block. Now the rescue choppers came in, behind the AH-1 Huey Cobras, landing noisily close to the main gate. The fire element split, with half deploying around the choppers, while the other half continued to hose the barracks. One of the gunships began circling the area now, like an anxious sheepdog on the prowl for wolves. The first Marines appeared, dragging the simulated prisoners in relays. Kelly could see Irvin checking and doing a count at the gate. There were shouts now, men calling off numbers and names, and the roar of the big Sikorsky choppers almost covered it all. The last Marines in were the fire support teams, and then the rescue choppers increased power and lifted off into the darkness.
"That was fast," Ritter breathed as the sound faded.
A moment later, two fire engines appeared to extinguish the blazes left behind by the various explosive devices. "That was 15 seconds under nominal," Kelly said, holding up his watch.
"What if something goes wrong, Mr. Clark?" Ritter asked.
Kelly's face lit up in a wicked grin.
"Some things did, sir. Four of the team were killed coming in. I assume maybe a broke leg or two."
"Wait a minute. You mean there's a chance?"
"Let me explain, sir," Kelly said.
"From the photos, there is no reason to believe there are any people between the LZ and the objective. No farming on those hills, okay? For tonight's exercise, I eliminated 4 people at random. Call all of them broken legs. The people had to be carried into the objective and carried out, in case you didn't notice. Backups on everything. Sir, I expect a clean mission, but I messed it up some tonight just to check."
Ritter nodded, impressed. "I expected everything to be run by the book for this rehearsal."
"In combat, things go wrong, sir. I allowed for that. Every man is cross-trained for at least one alternate job."
Kelly rubbed his nose. He'd been nervous, too.
"What you just saw was a successful simulated mission despite greater-than-expected complications.
This one's going to work, sir.
Mr. Clark, you sold me. The CIA field officer turned to the others. What about medical support, that sort of thing?
When Ogden forms up with Task Force 77, we cross-deck medical personnel over to her, Maxwell said. Kaz is on his way there now to brief the people in. CTF 77 is one of my people, and he'll play ball. Ogden's a pretty large boat. We'll have everything we need to care for them, medics, intel guys to debrief the works. She sails them right to Subic Bay. We hop them out of Clark ASAP. From the time the rescue choppers get off, we'll have them in California in 4.5 days.
Okay, this part of the mission looks fine. What about the rest?
Maxwell handled the answer.
Constellation's whole air group will be in support. Enterprise will be farther up north working the Haiphong area. That should get the attention of their air defense net and their high command. Newport News will be trolling the coast, shooting up AAA sites for the next few weeks. It's to be done randomly, and this area will be the fifth. She lays 10 miles out and lobs in heavy fire. The big anti-aircraft belt is within the range of her guns. Between the cruiser and the air group, we can blast a corridor for the helos to get in and out. Essentially, we'll be doing so much that they oughtn't to notice this mission until it's already over.
Ritter nodded. He'd read through the plan and had only wished to hear it from Maxwell. More to the point, to hear how he expressed himself. The Admiral was calm and confident, more so than Ritter had expected.
It's still very risky, he said after a moment.
It is that, Marty Young agreed.
What's the risk to our country if the people in that camp tell everything they know? Maxwell asked. Kelly wanted to step back from this part of the discussion. Danger to country was something beyond his purview. His reality was at the small unit level, or, more recently, even lower than that. And though his country's health and welfare started at that lowest common denominator, the big stuff required a perspective he didn't have. But there was no gracious way for him to withdraw, and so he stayed and listened and learned.
You want an honest answer? Ritter asked.
I'll give you one.
None.
Maxwell took it with surprising calm that concealed outrage.
Son, you want to explain that?
Admiral, it's a matter of perspective. The Russians want to know a lot about us, and we want to know a lot about them.
Okay, so this Zachary guy can tell them about SAC war plans, and the other notional people there can tell them other things. So we change our plans. It's the strategic stuff you're worried about, right? First, those plans change on a monthly basis. Second, do you ever think we'll implement them?
We might have to someday.
Ritter fished out a cigarette.
Admiral, do you want us to implement those plans?
Maxwell stood a little straighter.
Mr. Ritter, I flew my F-6F over Nagasaki just after the war ended. I've seen what those things do, and that was just a little one, which was all the answer anyone needed.
And they feel the same way.
How does that grab you, Admiral?
Ritter just shook his head.
They're not crazy either.
They're even more afraid of us than we are of them. What they learn from those prisoners might scare them enough to sober them up, even. It works that way, believe it or not.
Then why are you supporting... Are you supporting us?
Of course I am.
What a stupid question, his tone said, enraging Marty Young.
But why then, Maxwell asked.
Those are our people. We sent them. We have to get them back. Isn't that reason enough? But don't tell me about vital national security interests. You can sell that to the White House staff, even on the Hill, but not to me.
Either you keep faith with your people or you don't, said the field spook, who had risked his career to rescue a foreigner whom he hadn't even liked very much. If you don't, if you fall into that habit, then you're not worth saving or protecting, and then people stop helping you, and then you're in real trouble.
I'm not sure I approve of you, Mr. Ritter, General Young said. An operation like this will have the effect of saving our people. The Russians will respect that. It shows them we're serious about things. That will make my job easier, running agents behind the curtain. That means we'll be able to recruit more agents and get more information. That way I gather information that you want, okay? The game goes on until someday we find a new game.
That was all the agenda he needed. Ritter turned to Greer.
When do you want me to brief the White House?
I'll let you know. Bob, this is important. You are backing us.
Yes, sir, replied the Texan. For reasons that the others didn't understand, didn't trust, but had to accept.
So, what's the beef?
Look, Eddie, Tony said patiently. Our friend's got a problem. Somebody took down two of his people.
Who? Morello asked.
He was not in a particularly good mood. He'd just learned, again, that he was not a candidate to be accepted as a full member of the outfit. After all he'd done, Morello felt betrayed. Incredibly, Tony was siding with a black man instead of blood. They were distant cousins, after all. And now the bastard was coming to him for help, of course.
We don't know. His contacts, my contacts, we got nothing.
Well, ain't that just too fucking bad? Eddie segued into his own agenda. Tony, he came to me, remember? Through Angelo, and maybe Angelo tried to set us up, and we took care of that, remember? You wouldn't have this set up except for me, so now what's happening? I get shut out, and he gets closer in. So what gives, Tony? You gonna get him made?
Back off, Eddie.
How come you didn't stand up for me? Morello demanded.
I can't make it happen, Eddie. I'm sorry, but I can't.
Piaggi hadn't expected this conversation to go well, but neither had he expected it to go this badly, this quickly. Sure, Eddie was disappointed. Sure, he had expected to be taken in. But the dumb fuck was getting a good living out of it. And what was it about? Being inside or making a living? Henry could see that. Why couldn't Eddie? Then Eddie took it one step further.
I set this deal up for you. Now you got a little bitty problem, and who you come to? Me! You owe me, Tony.
The implications of the words were clear for Piaggi. It was quite simple from Eddie's point of view. Tony's position in the outfit was growing in importance. With Henry as a potential, a very real, major supplier, Tony would have more than a position. He would have influence. He'd still have to show respect and obeisance to those over him, but the command structure of the outfit was admirably flexible. And Henry's double-blind methods meant that whoever was his pipeline into the outfit had real security. Security of place in his organization was a rare and treasured thing. Piaggi's mistake was in not taking the thought one step further. He looked inward instead of outward. All he saw was that Eddie could replace him, become the intermediary, and then become the made man, adding status to his comfortable living. All Piaggi had to do was die, obligingly, at the right time. Henry was a businessman. He'd made the accommodation. Piaggi knew that. So did Eddie.
Don't you see what he's doing? He's using you, man.
The odd part was that while Morello was beginning to understand that Tucker was manipulating both of them, Piaggi, the target of that manipulation, did not. As a result, Eddie's correct observation was singularly ill-timed.
I've thought about that, Piaggi lied. What's in it for him? A link up with Philadelphia, New York?
Maybe. Maybe he thinks he can do it. Those people are getting awful big for their pants, man.
We'll sweat that one out later, and I don't see him doing that. What we want to know is who's taking his people down. You catch anything about somebody from out of town?
Put him on the spot, Piaggi thought. Make him commit. Tony's eyes bored in across the table at a man too angry to notice or care what the other man was thinking.
I haven't heard shit about that.
Put feelers out, Tony ordered. And it was an order. Morello had to follow it, had to check around.
What if he was taking out some people from inside, reliability problems like? You think he's loyal to anybody?
No, but I don't think he's offing his own people either. Tony rose with a final order. Check around.
Sure,
Eddie snorted, left alone at his table. Chapter 24 Hellos. People, that went very well, Captain Albee announced, finishing his critique of the exercise. There had been various minor deficiencies on the approach march, but nothing serious, and even his sharp eye had failed to notice anything of consequence on the simulated assault phase. Marksmanship especially had been almost inhumanly accurate,
and his men had sufficient confidence in one another that they were now running within mere feet of fire streams in order to get to their assigned places. The Cobra crews were in the back of the room, going over their own performance. The pilots and gunners were treated with great respect by the men they supported, as were the Navy flight crews of the rescue birds. The normal us-them antipathy found among disparate units was down to the level of friendly joshing. So closely had the men trained and dedicated themselves. That antipathy was about to disappear entirely. "Gentlemen," Albee concluded, "you're about to learn what this little picnic outing is all about." "Ten hut!" Irvin called. Vice Admiral Winslow Holland Maxwell walked up the center of the room, accompanied by Major General Martin Young. Both flag officers were in their best undress uniforms. Maxwell's whites positively glistened in the incandescent lights of the building, and Young's marine khakis were starched so stiff that they might well have been made of plywood. A marine lieutenant carried a briefing board that nearly dragged on the floor. This he set on an easel as Maxwell took his place behind the lectern. From his place on the corner of the stage, Master Gunnery Sergeant Irvin watched the young faces in the audience, reminding himself that he had to pretend surprise at the announcement. "Take your seats, Marines," Maxwell began pleasantly, waiting for them to do so. "First of all, I want to tell you for myself how proud I am to be associated with you. We've watched your training closely. You came here without knowing why, and you've worked as hard as any people I have ever seen. Here's what it's all about." The lieutenant flipped the cover off the briefing board, exposing an aerial photograph. "Gentlemen, this mission is called Boxwood Green. Your objective is to rescue 20 men, fellow Americans who are now in the hands of the enemy." John Kelly was standing next to Irvin, and he too was watching faces instead of the admiral. Most were younger than his, but not by much. Their eyes were locked on the reconnaissance photographs. An exotic dancer would not have drawn the sort of focus that was aimed at the blow-ups from the Buffalo Hunter drone. The faces were initially devoid of emotion. They were like young, fit, handsome statues, scarcely breathing, sitting at attention while the admiral spoke to them. "This man here is Colonel Robin Zacharias, U.S. Air Force," Maxwell went on, using a yard-long wooden pointer. "You can see what the Vietnamese did to him just for looking at the asset that snapped the picture." The pointer traced over to the camp guard about to strike the American from behind. "Just for looking up." Eyes narrowed at that, all of them, Kelly saw. It was a quiet, determined kind of anger, highly disciplined, but that was the deadliest kind of all, Kelly thought, suppressing a smile that only he would have understood. And so it was for the young Marines in the audience. It wasn't a time for smiles. Each of the people in the room knew about the dangers. Each had survived a minimum of 13 months of combat operations. Each had seen friends die in the most terrible and noisy way that the blackest of nightmares could create. But there was more to life than fear. Perhaps it was a quest. A sense of duty that few could articulate, but which all of them felt. A vision of the world that men shared without actually seeing. Every man in the room had seen death in all its dreadful majesty, knowing that all life came to an end. But all knew there was more to life than the avoidance of death. Life had to have a purpose, and one such purpose was the service of others. While no man in the room would willingly give his life away, every one of them would run the risk, trusting to God or luck or fate, in the knowledge that each of the others would do the same. The men in these pictures were unknown to the Marines, but they were comrades, more than friends, to whom loyalty was owed. And so they would risk their lives for them. "I don't have to tell you how dangerous the mission is," the admiral concluded. "The fact of the matter is, you know those dangers better than I do. But these people are Americans, and they have the right to expect us to come for them."
"Fucking ace, sir!"
a voice called from the floor, surprising the rest of the Marines. Maxwell almost lost it then. "It's all true," he told himself. "It really does matter. Mistakes and all, we're still what we are." "Thank you, Dutch," Marty Young said, walking to center stage. "Okay, Marines, now you know.
You volunteered to be here. You have to volunteer again to deploy. Some of you have families, sweethearts. We won't make you go. Some of you might have second thoughts, he went on, examining the faces, and seeing the insult he had caused them, not by accident. You have today to think it over. Dismissed. The Marines got to their feet, to the accompaniment of the grating sound of chairs scraping on the tile floor, and when all were at attention, their voices boomed as one. Recon! It was clear to those who saw the faces. They could no more shrink from this mission than they could deny their manhood. There were smiles now. Most of the Marines traded remarks with their friends, and it wasn't glory they saw before their eyes. It was purpose, and perhaps the look to be seen in the eyes of the men whose lives they would redeem. We're Americans, and we're here to take you home. Well, Mr. Clark, your admiral makes a pretty good speech. I wish we recorded it. You're old enough to know better, Guns. It's going to be a dicey one. Irvin smiled in a surprisingly playful way. Yeah, I know. But if you think it's a crock, why the hell are you going in alone? Somebody asked me to. Kelly shook his head and went off to join the admiral with a request of his own. She made it all the way down the steps, holding on to the banister, her head still hurting, but not so badly this morning, following the smell of the coffee to the sound of conversation. Sandy's face broke into a smile. "Well, good morning." "Hi," Doris said, still pale and weak, but she smiled back as she walked through the doorway, still holding on. "I'm real hungry. I hope you like eggs." Sandy helped her to a chair and got her a glass of orange juice. "I'll eat the shells," Doris replied, showing her first sign of humor. "You can start with these and don't worry about the shells," Sarah Rosen told her, shoveling the beginnings of a normal breakfast from the frying pan onto a plate. She had turned the corner. Doris's movements were painfully slow, and her coordination was that of a small child, but the improvement from only 24 hours before was miraculous. Blood drawn the day before showed still more favorable signs. The massive doses of antibiotics had obliterated her infections, and the lingering signs of barbiturates were almost completely gone. The remnants were from the palliative doses Sarah had prescribed and injected, which would not be repeated. But the most encouraging sign of all was how she ate. Awkwardness and all, she unfolded her napkin and sat it in the lap of the terrycloth robe. She didn't shovel the food in. Instead, she consumed her first real breakfast in months in as dignified a manner as her condition and hunger allowed. Doris was turning back into a person. But they still didn't know anything about her except her name, Doris Brown. Sandy got a cup of coffee for herself and sat down at the table. "Where are you from?" she asked in as innocent a voice as she could manage. "Pittsburgh." A place as distant to her house guest as the back end of the moon. "Family?" "Just my father. Mom died in 65. Breast cancer," Doris said slowly, then unconsciously felt inside her robe. For the first time she could remember, her breasts didn't hurt from Billy's attention. Sandy saw the movement and guessed what it meant. "Nobody else?" the nurse asked evenly. "My brother. Vietnam. I'm sorry, Doris. It's okay. Sandy's my name, remember?" "I'm Sarah," Dr. Rosen added, replacing the empty plate with a full one. "Thank you, Sarah." This smile was somewhat wan, but Doris Brown was reacting to the world around her now, an event far more important than the casual observer might have guessed. "Small steps," Sarah told herself. "They don't have to be big steps. They just have to head in the right direction." Doctor and nurse shared a look. There was nothing like it. It was too hard to explain to someone who hadn't been there and done it. She and Sandy had reached into the grave and pulled this girl back from grasping earth. 3 more months, Sarah had estimated, maybe not that long, and her body would have been so weakened that the most trivial outside influence would have ended her life in a matter of hours. But not now. Now this girl would live,
and the two medics shared without words the feeling that God must have known when he had breathed life into Adam. They had defeated death, redeeming the gift that only God could give. For this reason, both had entered their shared profession, and moments like this, one pushed back the rage and sorrow and grief for those patients whom they couldn't save. "Don't eat too fast, Doris. When you don't eat for a while, your stomach actually shrinks down some," Sarah told her, returning to form as a medical doctor. There was no sense in warning her about problems and pain sure to develop in her gastrointestinal tract. Nothing would stop it, and getting nourishment into her superseded other considerations at the moment.
"Okay, I'm getting a little full."
"Then relax a little. Tell us about your father."
"I ran away," Doris replied at once. "Right after David, after the telegram. And Daddy, he had some trouble, and he blamed me."
Raymond Brown was a foreman in the number 3 basic oxygen furnace shed of the Jones and Laughlin Steel Company, and that was all he was now. His house was on Dunleavy Street, halfway up one of the steep hills of his city, one of the many detached frame dwellings built around the turn of the century, with wood-clabbered siding that he had to paint every 2 or 3 years, depending on the severity of the winter winds that swept down the Monongahela Valley. He worked the night shift because his house was especially empty at night. Never more to hear the sounds of his wife. Never more to take his son to Little League or play catch in the sloped sanctity of his tiny backyard. Never more to worry about his daughter's dates on weekends. He'd tried, done everything a man could do after it was too late, which was so often the way of things. It had just been too much. His wife, discovering a lump, still a pretty young woman in her 37th year, his best and closest friend. He'd supported her as best he could after the surgery, but then came another lump, another surgery, medical treatment, and the downhill slide, always having to be strong for her until the end. It would have been a crushing burden for any man, and then followed by another. His only son, David, drafted, sent to Vietnam, and killed 2 weeks later in some nameless valley. The support of his fellow workers, the way they had come to Davy's funeral, hadn't stopped him from crawling inside a bottle, desperately trying to cling to what he had left, but too tightly. Doris had borne her own grief, something Raymond hadn't fully understood or appreciated, and when she'd come home late, her clothing not quite right, the cruel and hateful things he'd said. He could remember every word, the hollow sound as the front door had slammed. Only a day later he'd come to his senses, driving with tears in his eyes to the police station, abasing himself before men whose understanding and sympathy he never quite recognized, desperate again to get his little girl back, to beg from her the forgiveness that he could never give himself. But Doris had vanished. The police had done what they could, and that wasn't much. And so for 2 years he'd lived inside a bottle, until 2 fellow workers had taken him aside and talked as friends do once they have gathered the courage to invade the privacy of another man's life. His minister was a regular guest in the lonely house now. He was drying out. Raymond Brown still drank, but no longer to excess, and he was working to cut it down to 0. Man that he was, he had to face his loneliness that way. Had to deal with it as best he could. He knew that solitary dignity was of little value. It was an empty thing to cling to, but it was all he had. Prayer also helped, some, and in the repeated words he often found sleep, though not the dreams of the family which had once shared the house with him. He was tossing and turning in his bed, sweating from the heat, when the phone rang.
Hello?
Hello, is this Raymond Brown?
"Yeah, who's this?" he asked with closed eyes.
"My name is Sarah Rosen. I'm a doctor in Baltimore. I work at Johns Hopkins Hospital."
"Yes?"
The tone of her voice opened his eyes. He stared at the ceiling, the blank white place that so closely matched the emptiness of his life, and there was sudden fear. Why would a doctor from Baltimore call him? His mind was spinning off towards a named dread when the voice went on quickly.
I have somebody here who wants to talk to you, Mr. Brown.
Huh?
He next heard muffled noises that might have been static from a bad line, but was not.
I can't.
You have nothing to lose, dear, Sarah said, handing over the phone. He's your father. Trust him. Doris took it, holding it in both hands close to her face, and her voice was a whisper.
Daddy?
From hundreds of miles away, the whispered word came through as clearly as a church bell. He had to breathe three times before answering, and that came out as a sob.
Dor? Yes. Daddy, I'm sorry.
Are you okay, baby?
Yes, Daddy, I'm fine.
And incongruous as the statement was, it was not a lie.
Where are you? Wait a minute.
Then the voice changed. Mr. Brown, this is Dr. Rosen again.
She's there?
Yes, Mr. Brown, she is. We've been treating her for a week. She's a sick girl, but she's going to be okay. Do you understand? She's going to be okay. He was grasping his chest. Brown's heart was a steel fist, and his breathing came in painful gasps that a doctor might have taken for something they were not.
She's okay?
He asked anxiously. She's going to be fine, Sarah assured him. There's no doubt of that, Mr. Brown. Please believe me, okay?
Oh, sweet Jesus! Where are you?
Mr. Brown, you can't see her just yet. We will bring her to you just as soon as she's fully recovered. I worried about calling you before we could get you together, but we just couldn't not call you. I hope you understand. Sarah had to wait 2 minutes before she heard anything she could understand, but the sounds that came over the line touched her heart. In reaching into one grave, she had extracted two lives.
She's really okay?
She's had a bad time, Mr. Brown, but I promise you she will recover fully. I'm a good doc, okay? I wouldn't say that unless it were true.
Please, please let me talk to her again, please.
Sarah handed the phone over, and soon four people were weeping. Nurse and physician were the luckiest, sharing a hug and savoring their victory over the cruelties of the world. Bob Ritter pulled his car into a slot in West Executive Drive, the closed-off former street that lay between the White House and the Executive Office Building. He walked towards the latter, perhaps the ugliest building in Washington, no mean accomplishment, which had once held much of the executive branch of government, the state, war, and navy departments. It also held the Indian Treaty Room, designed for the purpose of overawing primitive visitors with the splendor of Victorian gingerbread architecture and the majesty of the government which had constructed this giant teepee. The wide corridors rang with the sound of his footsteps on marble as he searched for the right room. He found it on the second floor, the room of Roger McKenzie, special assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. Special, perversely, made him a second-line official. The National Security Advisor had a corner office in the West Wing of the White House. Those who reported to him had offices elsewhere, and though distance from the seat of power defined influence, it didn't define arrogance of position. McKenzie had to have a staff of his own in order to remind himself of his importance, real or illusory. Not really a bad man, and actually a fairly bright one, Ritter thought, McKenzie was nonetheless jealous of his position. And in another age he would have been the clerk who advised the chancellor who advised the king. Except today the clerk had to have an executive secretary. "Hi, Bob. How are things at Langley?" McKenzie asked in front of his secretarial staff, just to be sure they would know that he was meeting with an up-and-coming CIA official, and was therefore still very important indeed to have such guests calling on him. "The usual," Ritter smiled back. "Let's get on with it." "Trouble with traffic?" he asked, letting Ritter know that he was almost, if not quite, late for the appointment. "There's a little problem on the GW. Ritter gestured with his head toward McKenzie's private office. His host nodded. "Wally, we need someone to take notes."
"Coming, sir."
His executive assistant rose from his desk in the secretarial area and brought a pad. "Bob Ritter, this is Wally Hicks. I don't think you've met. How do you do, sir?" Hicks extended his hand. Ritter took it, seeing yet one more eager White House aide. New England accent, bright-looking, polite, which was about all he was entitled to expect of such people. A minute later they were sitting in Mackenzie's office, the inner and outer doors closed in the cast-iron frames that gave the executive office building the structural integrity of a warship. Hicks hurried himself about to get coffee for everyone, like a page at some medieval court, which was the way of things in the world's most powerful democracy. "So, what brings you in, Bob?" Mackenzie asked from behind his desk. Hicks flipped open his notepad and began his struggle to take down every word. "Roger, a rather unique opportunity has presented itself over in Vietnam." Eyes opened wider and ears perked up. "What might that be?" "We've identified a special prison camp southwest of Haiphong," Ritter began, quickly outlining what he knew and what they suspected. Mackenzie listened intently. Pompous though he might have been, the recently arrived investment banker was also a former aviator himself. He'd flown B-24s in the Second World War, including the dramatic but failed mission to Ploiești. A patriot with flaws, Ritter told himself. He would try to make use of the former while ignoring the latter. "Let me see your imagery," he said after a few minutes, using the proper buzzword instead of the more pedestrian pictures. Ritter took the photo folder from his briefcase and set it on the desk. Mackenzie opened it and took a magnifying glass from a drawer. "We know who this guy is." "There's a better photo in the back," Ritter answered helpfully. Mackenzie compared the official family photo with the one from the camp, then with the enhanced blow-up. "Very close. Not definitive, but close. Who is he?" "Colonel Robin Zacharias, Air Force. He spent quite some time at Offutt Air Force Base, SAC war plans. He knows everything, Roger." Mackenzie looked up and whistled, which he thought was what he was supposed to do in such circumstances. "And this guy's no Vietnamese. He's a colonel in the Soviet Air Force, name unknown, but it isn't hard to figure what he's there for. Here's the real punchline." Ritter handed over a copy of the wire service report on Zacharias' death. "Damn. Yeah, all of a sudden it gets real clear, doesn't it?" "This sort of thing could wreck the peace talks," Mackenzie thought aloud. Walter Hicks couldn't say anything. It wasn't his place to speak in such circumstances. He was like a necessary appliance, an animated tape machine, and the only real reason he was in the room at all was so his boss would have a record of the conversation. "Wreck the peace talks," he scribbled down, taking the time to underline it, and though nobody else noticed, his fingers went white around the pencil. "Roger, the men we believe to be in this camp know an awful lot, enough to seriously compromise our national security." "I mean seriously," Ritter said calmly. "Zacharias knows our nuclear war plans. He helped write PSYOP. This is very serious business." Merely in speaking PSYOP, merely by invoking the unholy name of the Single Integrated Operations Plan, Ritter had knowingly raised the stakes of the conversation. The CIA field officer amazed himself at the skillful delivery of the lie. The White House pukes might not grasp the idea of getting people out because they were people, but they had their hot issues, and nuclear war plans were the unholy of unholies in this and many other temples of government power. "You have my attention, Bob." "Mr. Hicks, right?" Ritter asked, turning his head. "Yes, sir. Could you please excuse us?" The junior assistant looked to his boss, his neutral face imploring Mackenzie to let him stay in the room, but that was not to be. "Wally, I think we'll carry on for the moment in executive session," the special assistant to the president said, easing the impact of the dismissal with a friendly smile, and a wave towards the door. "Yes, sir." Hicks stood and walked out the door, closing it quietly. "Fuck," he raged to himself, sitting back down at his desk. How could he advise his boss he didn't hear what came next? Robert Ritter, Hicks thought. The guy who'd nearly destroyed sensitive negotiations at a particularly sensitive moment by violating orders and bringing some goddamn spy out of Budapest. The information he'd brought had somehow changed the U.S. negotiating position, and that had set the treaty back 3 months, because America had decided to chisel something else out of the Soviets, who had been reasonable as hell to concede the matters already agreed to. That fact had saved Ritter's career, and probably encouraged him in that idiotically romantic view that individual people were more important than world